Gaonim, right? Last time we talked about the, you know, what it was that caused the end of the period of the Gaonim. Now we officially start on the post-Gaonim period with Shmuel HaNagid. Nagid means what? What's a Nagid?
Prince.
Prince. Sorry?
Leader.
Right, so it's really it, right, no, different from Magid. They, although can be connected, to be fair, it's a leader. The term Nagid comes to mean sort of like prince, but it really is one who leads. In Targum on the Chumash, when you talk about moving something forward, often the Aramaic for it is Nagid. So it's the one who leads, the one who takes everybody forward. That's the idea. That's one of those cases in which you could argue it's sort of its meaning and its opposite, because it's not oppositional, it's actually bringing people forward. I don't know. Not sure what to do with that. But we have a lot of information about Shmuel HaNagid, because we have his writing. He wrote a ton. We got his letters. We have the poems that he wrote, which we'll be seeing. There's a lot in the Cairo Geniza about him. There's a lot about him in Arab writers of the time, Jewish writers of the time and later. We've been using Sefer HaKabbalah from the first Ravid, Rabbi Avram Ibn Daud. He talks a lot about Shmuel HaNagid. So we have a lot of information. And what I wanted to show you to start off, the first four items here on the source sheet, are just some of his poetry, to see a little bit of the diversity of this person. Writing poetry in and of itself don't think that, oh wow, this is amazing that he also wrote poetry. Like anyone who was anybody wrote poetry back in the day. That was just what you did if you lived in Muslim Spain. So if you take a look at number one, this one comes from, believe it or not, the Penguin Book of Hebrew Verse. Who knew there was a Penguin Book of Hebrew Verse, published in 1981. So he had three collections of his poetry. One of them is called Ben Tehillim, one of them is called Ben Mishlei, and one of them is called Ben Koheles. And they have different themes. So this one, the first one, is from the Ben Tehillim, one of his compilations. And I'll read it out in the Hebrew, because I think that adds to an appreciation of it as verse. If you just read it in the English, it doesn't quite do the same thing. But you can see my English translation here. Actually, that one is not my English translation. That, I think, is the Penguin Book of Hebrew Verses translation. I don't think I did that one. Me'adam bimar'ehu, v'arev l'shosehu, umazug be'aspamya, v'zichro elei hodu. Okay, this is a poem about wine. Red to the eye, sweet to the drinker. You can see the translation there. Poured out in Spain, its bouquet reaches India. V'chalash ba'aganav, aval ba'aloso, el rashim azay yirdeh, berashim asher yirdu. There's a good bit of wordplay there going at the end of it. When it goes to the head, it holds sway over swaying heads. They did a nice job, actually, with that translation. They captured, I think, what's going on. V'shachul asher damav, mechusim bedim osav, yegonav bedam eshkal, yinusun v'yerdu. So the shachul, they translate as wretch. Shachul is one who is bereaved. That's really the translation. The bereaved one whose blood is covered in his tears, damav mechusim bedim osav. He gets rid of his sorrow, and there you see eshkal from shachul in the beginning of the line. Yinusun v'yerdu. His sorrows are going to go with the blood of. Oh, it's not Eshkol, Eshkol, sorry. Bedam Eshkol, yinusun v'yerdu. His sorrows are going to go away with the blood of the grape. Ke'ilu yididim, es yisuvum ashish osav, miyad liyad goral, ale yahalom yado. So the goblets make the rounds, they go from hand to hand. It seems as if the friends are casting lots for a diamond. That's not a bad translation, they just change the order of things in the sentence. But this is a poem about wine. Fundamentally, it's a poem about wine. Not exactly what I might have expected from, like, great Talmud Chacham political leader. He writes a poem about wine. So much so that when I use this in a shiur several years ago. Someone suggested to me that maybe it's a metaphor for wisdom or for learning or something like that. But I tend to think not. I tend to think this is actually about wine. Like, we do use wine for Kedusha. This is true. There's none of that in here.
Right.
This is not like, you know, he's not saying use it for Kiddush.
Right.
You know, he's just talking about the uses people make of wine. I think it's just, this is not a poem designed for shul. This is a poem designed for people who are sitting around drinking wine. That's what it is. On the other hand, if you take a look at number two, you see a poem about allying yourself with a wicked person. This is from Mishle. And of course, if you've learned Mishle, I'm teaching it now on Tuesday afternoons, but if you've learned Mishle, you know Mishle gives you a lot of life advice. Short, pithy statements, which may have deeper levels of meaning, but you could read them on the surface and just get basic life ideas. So he has here in his collection of poems, Ben Mishle, they're modeled on Mishle, Al Nasihi Chaver La Rasha, Gam Al Yihi Rasha Bechel Kecha, Ki Hu Alei Risho Yeshivecha, Terem Tishiveyu Litzidkecha. He says, don't be a friend to the wicked person, and don't let the wicked person be in your lot, because he's going to make you bad before you make him good. Right? I mean,
influenced.
Yeah. What does it remind you of from Pirkei Avos?
I was just thinking that. I'll draw your friends.
Al tischaber larasha. Don't join with a wicked person. Right? That's the line in Pirkei Avos in the first parak. He took that and kind of expanded the idea and gave it a meaning.
Yeah,
that's,
even if you were intending to make him righteous.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's not so strange that it would have the similarity to Pirkei Avos, because my theory is Pirkei Avos is built on Mishle. In the sense that a lot of what you see discussed in Pirkei Avos is originally found in Mishle, on a lot of different levels. It feels very much like that. There are actually communities in which, just like we learn Pirkei Avos on Shabbos afternoon during the summer, so historically there were Sephardi communities that learned Mishle as well during summer Shabbos afternoons. So that's his collection of poetry that's called Ben Mishle, because he modeled his poems on the ideas of Mishle. Correct. Zero. Another one in number three. This one is about war. He says, Krav domeb barosho el yefefa asher kol ish lasachek bayave v'sofo kizikeinam usa asher kol shochara yivkev yidve. So I apologize if this insults anybody. But his message is a cautionary message about war. Keep in mind, one of his roles was that he was the minister of war. So what he says, you know, should carry some weight. He says people find war really attractive in the beginning, but in the end, it causes them to grieve. It doesn't turn out well. So at this point, we've seen three poems, right? We've got one which is about wine, one which is about your friends, right? Another one which is about war, and then one more. And this last one, finally, is a religious poem. It's something that fits better with people's image, I think, of Shmuel HaNagid. He says, "Bisam yirah terafe," or yeah, probably terafe at, "chali libach ve'enecha," or terape at, "chali libach ve'enecha," "ubelashon maaseh tatzdik asher diber lashonecha." He says, with the sam, the medicine of yirah, of awe of Hashem, you will heal the sickness of your heart and your eyes. And with the tongue of deeds, you're going to justify that which your tongue spoke. You follow what he's saying? What's the message here?
It has the power to go either way. Speech?
Okay. I was thinking of something else, sorry. Yiras Shemayim in the first one, for sure. And the idea of Yiras Hashem as marpe, as a healing thing, sorry?
No, also, like, what you say, like, you should do, basically. Like, say what you mean and mean what you say.
Right. Don't rely on your speech. Do things, right? And more ma'at vasei harbe, if you want the Pirkei Avos analog. right? He says, justify what your tongue spoke with the tongue of your actions. Let your actions speak for you, is essentially what he's, you know, what he's trying to say here. So we see diverse interests here. We see somebody who seems to be very comfortable at a banquet with wine. We see somebody who has just general advice about war, dealing with wicked people. And then you see somebody who is counseling Yiras Hashem, Morma Advase Harbe, that kind of thing. All of these are found in Shmuel HaNagid. In number 5, I gave you 2 things that are worth reading for those who want to know more about him. The first one is in Hebrew, and it's available on HebrewBooks.org, and that is a collection of his writings. And then the other, and also, I mean, in 2, I gave you the link where you can find Ben Mishlei on Hebrew Books. And then the other, in English, is The Jews of Modern Spain, Volume 2, by Eliyahu Ashtor. He has a lot on Shmuel HaNagid. Also, in general, it's a very good set of books to read.
Did Rabbi Turchiner specifically highlight these sayings for a reason? Like, are you bringing this up?
So I
came a little late, I apologize.
No, that's all right. That's all right. You just threw me when you said, did Rabbi Turchiner? I was like, the answer is that I picked these just to show his diversity, the fact that he's not what one might have expected. You know, when you start reading about figures who have been introduced as part of sort of giants of Jewish history and giants of our Masorah, so you might expect, you know, poem number 4. You would maybe see numbers 2 and 3. Number 1 is completely left field. So that is definitely part of it. He is not the only one. That is for sure. We'll see more of that because we're going to have to see others from this period who also wrote poetry. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi writes poetry. The Clonimus family in Italy writes poetry. Like we're going to be seeing more than just Shmuel HaNagid, and we'll see what kinds of poetry they write.
Is he a political head, or is
yes.
he a halachic head?
He's in everything head.
He's in everything.
He's in everything, yeah. Isha Eshkolot.
Do you see his halakhic writings?
We'll get there.
Yeah?
Yep. We're going to see that. We're going to see, yeah, a lot. So, in order to understand more about Shmuel HaNagid, we need to take a step back and understand just like his world in which he's operating, because that really affects how we understand him. I didn't mention his actual name. He wasn't named HaNagid, like that wasn't the thing. So he's Shmuel ben Yosef Halevi ibn Nagrila. Nagrila or Nagdila? Unclear.
And wait, what year is Shmuel?
So we're gonna do that. We'll talk about that. But basically what you're talking about is 11th century Spain. 11th century Muslim Spain. So, in order to understand his world, you need to know about 2 different populations. One, Arabs, and the other, Berbers. So we talked a little bit about the Berbers, I think, at some point. Nonetheless, the Arabs originate in the Arabian Peninsula, that's Arab, primarily in the area that today is called Saudi Arabia. They are identified as their own ethnic group long, long ago, like for the last 3,000 years or so, they've been known as the people from Arav, Arabs. The Berbers, on the other hand, come from North Africa. If you remember when we did the map of the areas around the Mediterranean, so they originate in the areas of eastern Morocco, all along the southern coast of the Mediterranean, until you get to the western end of Egypt. That's all an area that the Berbers are originally found in, although they're best known for the Morocco Association. That's where they become powerful. So Shmuel HaNagid's story has to start out about 200 years before his time. At this point, there is a caliphate called the Umayyad Caliphate. The caliphate is essentially a Muslim-driven empire in the world at that time. The Umayyads were Arab. They actually began as a political unit before Islam, and then they embraced Islam very early on. They were early adopters. So end of the 7th century, they become a caliphate in that region. However, middle of the 8th century, they're driven out by the Abbasids. That's the way these empires work. It's an empire, they're there for a generation or two, and then a new empire comes up and chases the old one out. So they get chased out by the Abbasids, but they don't fall apart. Their leadership flees to Andalusia. Andalusia, right, written in English always as Andalusia, is based in more or less what we call today Spain and Portugal. I gave you a map on the sheet in number 6. I'll explain the borders and stuff. But that's basically the region that is the center of their power. And the rise of their caliphate based in Cordoba catalyzes the birth of a new Sephardic community there. We've talked about them a little bit already when we talked about Rav Haigon. We talked about the growth of the center in Spain. So now we're talking about why that happens. Except it's not called Spain. We're calling it Andalusia. Exactly. So the Jews there had two reasons not to follow the Gaon and the Reish Galusa based in Babel. Number one, there was a lot of hostility by the Umayyads. They didn't want the Jews going back to Babel because they wanted the Jews to follow local authorities. They weren't interested in having the Jews be loyal to something outside of their control, where the Abbasids were. They're worried about the Jews leaving. They're worried about losing their financial capital. They're worried about disloyalty. Maybe the Abbasids see the Jews as an opportunity to gain a foothold and to undermine the Umayyads. So the Umayyads don't like having the Jews go elsewhere for their religious leadership. And then the other is a story which somebody here actually referenced at some point. It might have been Dasi, I'm not sure. It was somebody sitting in that area on the table. It could have been you. I think it was Dasi. The result of a story that is called in Hebrew the story of the Arba Shvuyim. Yeah. The story of the four captives. And this is the story that shows up in the Ravid's book Sefer HaKabbalah, or Seder HaKabbalah as it's sometimes called. The story is supposed to have happened in the time of Rav Shrira Gaon. Somewhere, bless you, in the second half of the 10th century. I've seen it dated as 995. That's a little bit difficult. Some put it as the year 965. Some people put it even earlier. But the story is what we're really focusing on. And second half of the 10th century. Anyone hear this story before? The four exiles? Okay, so maybe it was you. Sorry? You're familiar with it. Yes, that's the one. You got it. So the story, the boat from Italy. So the story was that there were four chachamim. Sorry?
Sounds like a play.
Yeah. There were four chachamim who were based in the yeshivos in Babel, I think particularly Sura, who somehow find themselves in Italy. That's one of the things that historians wonder about with the story, like why were they in Italy? It's the wrong place. Nonetheless, they get on a boat from the city of Bari in Italy on some kind of fundraising mission. And versions of this differ in terms of what they're raising money for. But they're taken captive, and they're ransomed in different lands where they then go on to spread Torah. So it's effectively how the Torah of the yeshivas in Babel ends up spreading and creating new centers or reviving centers that are elsewhere. So
They kept being redeemed in different cities?
Yeah, one of them was redeemed here, one was redeemed here, one was redeemed here. Yeah. So one of them is Rabbeinu Chushiel. I don't know if we've mentioned yet Rabbeinu Chananel. Rabbeinu Chananel is a major leader of the yeshiva in Kerwan. In the early Rishonim time. We haven't gotten to him yet in our history. But remember, we talked about Kerwan, right? Kerwan, which is Carthage, mm-hmm. right, in Tunisia. So they have a major yeshiva there. They're the ones who wrote the letter to Rav Shrira Gaon that led to the Igeres Rav Shrira Gaon, his big record of the history of Judaism. So Rabbeinu Chananel's father, Rabbeinu Chushiel, is one of these shvuyim. He's one of these captives. The second one, Rav Shmaryahu ben Elchanan is ransomed in Egypt, in Alexandria, and community builds up there as a result. There's another one, we don't know who he is, what the name is not recorded, where he went, we just know he was there, part of the story. I feel like he's the Eino Yodei Elishol in our group of four, I don't know. And then the one who matters most for us is Rav Moshe ben Chanoch, because Rav Moshe ben Chanoch is ransomed in Andalusia. There are theories about the other one and who the other one was, but I haven't seen anything concrete.
Was the one
yes.
who jumped off the boat.
Off the boat, yes. You really do know this story. I wasn't
I
even going to go to that
it.
Part.
Whose wife? There was only one
wife. No, but Rav Moshe ben Chanoch's wife was apparently very attractive, and the captain of the ship, or the head of the of their captors, was going to use her for himself. And she jumps. She asks, am I getting into Olam Haba if I drown? And he says yes, and she jumps off the boat.
It's her chance to make them.
Yeah, right. Yes. Correct. Which is a story the Gemara tells about the Roman exiles. The Gemara itself has that story, you know, 1,000 years before. So, the I'm not sure what you mean by saying it's crazy, but I'm going to leave that. Yes. So, Rav Moshe ben Chanoch gives the community in Spain, in Andalusia, its own leader now who they can consult. They don't need to go back to Babel because they have a Talmud Chacham there, and he has a student, Rabbi Yosef ben Yitzchak ben Avitur, who, according to one story I've seen, I haven't been able to track it down in terms of its source, actually translates Shas into Arabic for a Muslim leader who was interested in reading it. Very interesting idea. But we do know there were still ties to the Gaonim, because we know, we've said already, Shmuel Hanagid is a Talmud of Rav Haigon. So we know that there are still connections. But the result of this is that the community starts to become independent of the Gaonim. It's also, as we talked about, a time when the yeshivos are in decline, which, you know, which helps. So at the same time, the Berbers are becoming powerful in Cordoba. There's a major shift in that caliphate. There's a lot of trouble internally. There are assassinations, there are rebellions, and the empire that they've built starts to fall apart. And the caliph says, I need basically armed forces. And he goes to the Berbers, and he brings in the Berbers as mercenaries. He hires them to basically be his, his army, more or less. And as the Berbers get more control, that's actually better for the Jews in many areas. The Berbers tended to be less militant in their approach to the Jews. And so that actually works well. But as the caliphate becomes a mess, you get a lot of independent provinces. They break away. And that's the map that you see in number 6. These are what are called taifas. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but I've invented that as my pronunciation of the word, and I'm sticking with it. So, but I didn't print this one in color. I apologize. But I didn't think it mattered so much. The point is simply to show you, in this region, you have different provinces, taifas, with different alliances between them. So that's going to matter in terms of the rise and career of Shmuel HaNagid. This is an environment in which the Muslim government now becomes looser. The Berbers have no problem giving Jews high positions in the taifas. And it's also an environment in which strict Islam kind of falls away. You may not, I don't know how much you know about halacha in Islam, but they're very, very strict about depictions of human beings. They're very strict about that in Islamic art. But at this point in history, you start to see in this region that they have pictures of human beings in their artwork because some of the strict Islam falls away. At this point, they're philosophically more liberal, and the result is that Jews are able, again, to advance more. In the areas that they're in control of.
When were they strict? No,
because the Umayyads were the ones who were strict for 300 years, 200 years before that. 200 years is a long time. Okay. What was 200 years ago? Right?
They pretty steady the whole.
Right. So that's one of the things that's important to get out of learning Jewish history is that it's been not steady. It's been up and down and up and down in different regions. We get kicked out of here and then we go there and then.
Yeah, but I'm saying a rule about not putting pictures in your art or whatever stays pretty steady for thousands of years.
And it did, except where the Berbers were, they loosened it, and for their period of power, it was looser. And then the Berbers fade away. I mean, yes. There's,
well, I think of 10th century as the beginning of Islam. I don't think of it as like, okay, they're already chilling out. Like,
right. So no, they start at the end of the 7th. Like they've been busy. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Shmuel HaNagid. That's all background. So Shmuel HaNagid comes from a family in the city, which I believe is called Merida. It's in one of these provinces on this map that you can't really see probably, but if you can, great. His family is not like leadership. They're not nobility, but they're respected. They move to Cordoba because Merida becomes involved in rebellions and disputes, and it's not a good place to raise kids. So Shmuel is born when they're already in Cordoba. He's born in the year 993. He had an older brother, Yitzchak, who passes away in the year 1041, and that was very upsetting to Shmuel HaNagid. He actually wrote Kinos for the death of his brother. He studies under great teachers. He is an apprentice in business to his father. He's very broadly educated. Hebrew, Arabic, Berber, European languages, Latin, the gamut. He's a great poet. If you liked the poetry that was in the first four sources, I don't know. If you didn't, then maybe he's not such a great poet. Fine. He's versed in the sciences, particularly astronomy, geometry, logic. He is well-read in the Quran, as well as Christian commentators on the Torah, and both of those come out in his writing. He marries the daughter of the Dayan of Malaga, which is one of the provinces. I always grew up thinking it was Malaga when it was on the way. So it's Malaga, apparently, or Malaga, I guess, if you're Canadian. So he marries the daughter of the Dayan, and he produces sons, Yosef and Eliasaf, as well as a son and a daughter who died in early childhood. I looked for the name of his wife. I can't find it anywhere. I apologize. He's very attached to his kids. He directs their education. His son, Yosef, is the oldest, and he accompanies him on his trips, and he trains Yosef to ultimately replace him. And Yosef actually marries the daughter of Rav Nissim Gaon, who was a leader in the yeshiva in Kairouan. So they're living in Cordoba, the family, again, when he's born. When he's 20 years old, the family flees from Cordoba to Malaga. There was a whole bit of strife going between the Umayyads and the ruler in Cordoba at the time. There was a massacre. A lot of Jews were in deep trouble in this. And Shmuel is in that flight. Shmuel becomes a trader in Malaga, but he's not happy with this life. And if you take a look at number 7, I brought you from Eliyahu Ashtor. He's describing it, and he says, but as he, Shmuel, sat in his shop in Malaga, he was overcome by depression and struggled powerfully with himself. There were no circles of young scholars or writers like himself with whom he could discourse and benefit thereby from their erudition, nor could he learn of or discuss new developments in literature and science. He suffered all the pain of one abruptly removed from his birthplace and the misery of loneliness. Ashtar is not inventing this. You see it in the Ben Tehillim writings of Shmuel HaNagid. He talks about how he wants to be among the Talmidei Chachamim. He wants to be learning. That's what he's looking for. And he wants to accomplish more for Klal Yisrael. So he's very unhappy where he is. He has made a good association with the Dayan in Malaga, whose name was Rabbi Yehuda, by the way. He also makes another associate, a fellow by the name of Ibn Khazm. Ibn Khazm was a Muslim scholar, and they debated religion. Now, Jews often did this because they were forced to do so. Certainly in Christian lands, the church would force them to do so. But a lot of this was about defending Judaism from those who were attacking it. So Ashtar gives you an example here. If you take a look in source number 8 of the debate with Ibn Khazm. As was usual among Muslim theologians, Ibn Khazm sought to demonstrate that the Torah of Jews was fraudulent and was not the holy book of God. Among the various verses he cited as unethical and thus proof of fraudulence, meaning we must have made it up because it teaches unethical behavior, is the phrase in Bereishis where Avram tells Sarah, right, say that you are my sister. So Shmuel HaLevi replied that sister in Hebrew can also mean a kinswoman. Achot doesn't have to mean your sister. Now, you're all thinking, well, I know that because I read Rashi. But keep in mind, Rashi's not around yet. Mm-hmm. Shmuel HaNagid is talking about this before there's a Rashi. Whereupon Ibn Khazm further cited the verse in elsewhere in Bereishis, Moreover, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, not the daughter of my mother. Right? So later on, there's a statement, no, she is my sister. So it goes back and forth between the two of them. Another one, the Muslim theologian did not fail to introduce an old argument employed in all such debates. Ibn Khazm asked how Shmuel would explain lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda, meaning the Torah says in Parashas Vayechi that the scepter shall not leave Yehuda, but who is the king who Shmuel anoints?
Shaul,
who is from what shevet?
Binyamin.
So all the Mefarshim deal with this question, because they have to deal with this question, because the Muslims are asking them, hey, what's that about? How is it? So they give different answers. One answer is that Shaul was only intended to be temporary. Another answer is that the Shevet is the powerful one. It doesn't mean that a king is necessarily going to come from that Shevet. It just means that Shevet is going to be powerful. There are different explanations that are offered for justifying it. And I don't have a record of Shmuel's response to it. But these are the types of debates that he's having with Ibn Khazm. So right now, he's a businessman in Malaga who is engaged in some kind of religious debate, you know, and is involved in the Jewish community, but he's frustrated. He becomes known for his erudition and his linguistic skills, and particularly his ability to write in Arabic when he moves to Granada, which is another of these Taifas, a name that I think is probably familiar more. He starts to write letters for the vizier of the local Berbers, but not as an assistant, but as like a consultant to an assistant of, and the assistant is taking the credit. So on a visit to the area, the vizier of the Berbers, this fellow named Ibn al-Arif, meets him, and he says, Shmuel, come work for me in Granada. So Shmuel becomes what's known as a tax farmer. You know what a tax farmer is?
Collect the tax from the Jews.
So the job of a tax farmer is that the tax farmer buys the right to collect taxes. In other words, the government says we can expect to make, I'm making up numbers obviously, but the government says we can expect to make $1 billion if we collect the taxes ourselves, but we also have to invest a lot, and you know, people don't always pay, and it's a pain. So somebody comes to the government and says, I'll pay you $700 million. And then I get to collect the taxes.
A broker.
Right. So that's called a tax farmer. And that's what he engages in. He goes to the government and he buys the right to collect the taxes, and he collects the taxes and you know, gets to keep them and use them. And he gives other people jobs as, you know, as part of this. But you'll be shocked to know that there were Jews who were jealous of his success. And particularly because he's bringing in people to work who aren't necessarily locals from Granada. He's bringing in people he's met in his travels. He brought in the son of the Dayan of Malaga, for example, to be engaged in this. So they tell the government that Shmuel is becoming really rich because he's collecting too much stuff. He's collecting too much money. Mm-hmm. And he goes to jail in the year 1020. They also hire thugs who kill the Dayan of Malaga. They kill his nephew. Yeah, it's not a pretty scene.
The Jews do?
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I'm lost track of how much time we have, so I don't want to lose Parsha. Oh, okay. So just quickly to wrap this point. He gets out of jail. He's fined. He loses his position. And he learns a major lesson, which is, even if you're successful, don't let other people see it. He was too public with his success, and it came back to bite him. Not that you can blame him for it, but still. So the vizier, al-Arif, takes Shmuel back, and Shmuel becomes more successful than he was before, and ultimately he becomes the collector of taxes from all the Jews in the Berber-controlled areas, and that's when the Jews start calling him Nagid, the leader who draws others along. That leads to him becoming the Minister of Finance. But that, I think, is where we'll have to pick up next time. What I want to do, like, we're just giving a lot of history right now, but I want to talk a little bit more about the finance stuff and the war that he gets involved in, and then talk about him as a leader among us and his Torah and his leadership, you know, of the Jews in Andalusia, his writings and so on. So that'll have to be next time. Okay? Oh, the Jewish Encyclopedia is a predecessor of the Encyclopedia Judaica. It was published in the last decade of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. It's available free online. You can cut and paste it, which is, you know, why I used it. because it's available. The problem with it is that some things are just not correct, meaning you've had 100 to 120 years since it was published, and there's stuff in it that has just been shown to be wrong. And I don't mean wrong from just from a Jewish perspective, but just
out of date or wrong?
Wrong. I'll give you my favorite example of it. Under Apple, their entry under Apple, they say Tapuach in Tanakh does not mean apple, which is something some Rishonim said. Tapuach in Tanakh does not mean apple. Why? Because there are no apple orchards in Israel, or what they're writing, Palestine. There are no apple orchards there. The word tapuach itself is a very flexible word. It just means something that's kind of round, maybe bloated, right? Nun peches, right? We use it for tapuach on a tree, but we also use tapuach adama for the potato, tapuach zahav for an orange. So their argument is that it's not apple. However, in the 1950s, archaeologists discover that there absolutely had been apple orchards there. The Romans destroyed them. And not only that, but they discovered that these were fragrant apple orchards in particular, which fits with Shir HaShirim, where the apple that talks about specifically the reyach of the tapuchim, it fits very well. But when they were publishing the Jewish Encyclopedia, they didn't know that. So if you look online in the Jewish Encyclopedia, you look up apple, you'll see this entry, which is just factually incorrect.
Wow. And it was written in English originally.
In English. I believe that's the original. I don't think it's
like
translated from something.
End
of the 19th century, if I would have had to guess, I would say it was probably out of Philadelphia, because you had a lot of Jewish publishing in English that goes on in the latter half of the 19th century. Out of there, Isaac Leeser, the Jewish Publication Society, all of that's Philadelphia-based, I believe.
Cool. That's
Really cool. Okay, cool. Yep. Available online. Just go find the mistakes. Okay.